You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Whitney Otto, the author of Now You See Her, recently published by Villard Books. She's the author, of course, as well, of How to Make an American Quilt. Wasn't that a nice of course?
Yes, that was wonderful.
this is a more, what would you say, metaphysical or mysterious book.
I think so,
than
yes.
Than American Quilt. And I wondered what its inception was.
Oh, gosh. Probably on a very basic level, observing my mother's own aging when she had been widowed 10 years and she was in her 50s and I was in my late 20s, and sort of noting the ways in which her social life had changed. I mean, that was the first thing I noticed. It didn't look the same as it did when she had been married. And since she'd been married twice, I had a couple of marriages to compare that to. And then it just seemed that she didn't have small children and she was no longer young. And there were a lot of things, and I began to somehow feel that she was being edged to the side a little bit, and not because she was any less confident or any less herself or any less vital or anything like that. Her life just seemed to change in ways that didn't seem quite pleasing to me, mm-hmm. although she never saw it that way. So that's sort of a basic background to it. And then beyond that, maybe my own aging comes into it, although I don't feel like Kiki Shaw. I don't know. So it's kind of hard to say, in a way. I think sometimes stories choose you, and you're not really sure why.
Well, it's true that the material with Jen, especially the long chapter about cooking toward the end of the book, seems very much at its heart, especially yeah. when Kiki notices that her mother, Jen, is starting to have the appearance of someone who eats alone. She eats like a wolf, Kiki says, and will try things on in stores as if she is invisible. But it seemed as if almost as if this particular set of characters became like elements of a tarot deck. I know that the metaphor in the book is of the quiz show, answers without questions and that kind of thing. But I felt a gradual seeping in of mysticism, myths about the moon, a whole kind of mystic array in this book.
I think so, and I think in part that may be because I mean, Kiki doesn't fit into a definite slot. I mean, she's sort of the observer and the chronicler. But I think with Collier Gray, who is the mistress, or Les, who is the wife, or Nora, who is the secretary, and Jen, who is the widow, they do sort of take on very specific female experiences in a very, I want to say almost archetypal way or something. Mm-hmm. Although my hope, my desire was to make them full-fledged characters. But it was one way of getting at women's experiences by sort of depicting the different sort of lives that are traditionally open to women and seem to still be open to women. For good or bad, there hasn't been a lot of change. I mean, I don't see any fewer mistresses or any fewer, you know, wives and mothers who are home sort of wondering how their roles all add up, or any fewer secretaries, certainly. So that may be part of what seems tarot-like about it, too. And then it's true, talking about the moon or talking about madness or talking about, I'm trying to think of what else was in there. There's a little bit of women's history. But, yeah, I think so. And then the idea that Kiki is literally disappearing sort of gives it a slightly fantastic element.
Well, the whole thing has the feeling of the box that Kiki buys in a small shop. It's like a Victorian box in which a magician is running a hoop around a floating woman. It has the feeling of a collage diorama of some sort.
Yes. And I think, too, when I write, I tend to think that I'm sort of a verbal collagist or something. That seems to be the best way I can get at my own stories. is by patching and placing certain things and circling until I can get to what seems to be the core of the story or something.
Now, did it worry you at all? The central metaphor, as we've mentioned, is vanishing, but this comes so close to the idea of invisibility in The Invisible Man. And it seems as if, in a way, it's the subsequent generation's book, that if blacks... Well, I have the feeling that black Americans, African Americans, have retreated back into invisibility, but there's been a new generation, and this idea of women vanishing as they get older, that they disappear from the mainstream of culture... Did the closeness concern you?
Not so much. I like to think sometimes that I write within certain traditions and expand on those traditions. I'm not an experimental writer, even though my writing is not absolutely traditional. And I think too, in choosing my subject matter, I feel that I'm always within a tradition. And I think the idea of invisibility, whether it's Ellison's Invisible Man, or I think it was H.G. Wells' Invisible Man, or who's ever... The idea of invisibility equaling being marginalized is such a close connection, and I really believe that I could have written about any group in this country, either age, either young or old, any class, region, religion, gender, sexual preference, whatever it would be. I could write about any group, and I could apply the invisibility. My particular focus happened to be women, and in a more defined sense, women aging. And I think, too, perhaps one difference is I don't know that women aging is a problem as much as it's sort of a condition. I don't know that there's an answer for it or a really good way around it. And I think aging does, in general, America does not know what to do with its aging population, or its aged population, and whether that's men or women. But I do think that the gender difference there has to do with the fact that it hits women harder and younger in a much more physical way. And again, that's closer to the Invisible Man, whereas men in this country seem to be defined by profession, wealth, power. That's their visibility. So when they're much older and they're forced to retire, or they leave a job, or they're fired from a job, they are suddenly at odds. They don't know who they are because that is their definition. Whereas women tend to be defined youth, beauty, the ability to have children. And so again, what I wanted to say is sort of like Ellison's Invisible Man, because women are defined in a very physical sense, they wake up with it and they go to bed with it every night. They cannot change what their genetics do to them. Whereas if men are defined more by something that's external, they can still walk in a room and be seen as a handsome man or a stately man or a distinguished man. If a man is older and he's balding or he has a little paunch or he has lines or something else physical, it's understood that he's older and that's what happens. But with women, she can have 6 children, and if she's a little overweight, if she has lines, the feeling seems to be she didn't take care of herself, she let herself go. And yet she's fighting genetics just the same as he may be.
The last line in the book, which in a way is something like the first line of a book, is that Kiki, who has met her ghostly prototype, Kiki of Montparnasse, and gotten advice about how one demands attention. And Kiki points out that Kiki is known outside of Man Ray's appropriation of her or Montparnasse's appropriation of her, that people know who she was as well as they know the photographs of her. Our Kiki Shaw, speaks about wanting to talk about her ideas, which she says was rough in the beginning because she did not know the language of her own story. Now, this book, more than I thought, How to Make an American Quilt, by my guest Whitney Otto, was Virginia Woolf-like in its attempt to find a language special to this character. And as a result, I think there's much more metaphor, imagery, incorporeality, I guess, mm-hmm. in all of its versions seems to be central to this book. And I wondered if you could talk about the language of it.
Oh, gosh. Let's see, Michael. I guess what I wanted to talk about in a way with language in this book, I mean, she is working on a language category, and that's scattered throughout the book, these word definitions. And they seem to relate back more or less to the idea of love and invisibility or visibility. So she's working on specifically on language. And I think beyond that, she doesn't even know how to talk about her own life. She only knows how to talk about the lives of her friends and her family. She discovers she's disappearing. She doesn't know why this is, so she thinks she will look into her own life. And in the beginning of the book, she sits down and she makes a list, for example, of what she has. Then she makes a list of what she wants. And there's something that she can't quite break in that, so she needs to call her friends and find out what their want lists would be or their lists of desires. And she always seems to retreat back into the brightness of their lives or something rather than her own. And also, the book is divided into categories, which sort of reflects what she does for a living. It also reflects how she thinks. And on a slightly broader scale, it reflects, I think, how America thinks, that we're very comfortable with categories. We're very comfortable in saying, well, you know, she is this and this. She is old, for example. And then we don't have to explain anything more about her. And we lapse into these categories and sort of a hammering down of complexity to simplicity, and yet all of us are so complex. And so she doesn't really know how to talk about herself in particular, and she sort of knows how to talk about her friends, and she doesn't know how to express herself, really. She's pretty inarticulate overall.
Well, I'm thinking in particular of a certain chain in the book, just as an example. Working on a, I guess, Jeopardy-like show, she is coming up with words, and she comes up with the word chordate, mm-hmm. Which means shaped like the heart. She has seen a heart-shaped piece of jewelry on a woman at lunch, and later she runs into the word ex voto on another one of her lists, which is giving a part of the body as a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And she begins to think that all of the jewelry that she sees in the shapes of hearts are all of the hearts that women have sacrificed, perhaps to men, perhaps to life. And the book takes on a strange level at which words and objects and the idea of removing literally a part of the body as a manifestation of disappearance. This is the thing I found most interesting.
Oh, I understand. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Very much. there's something else that someone else had said, not exactly like that, but talked about this book just being this complete deconstruction, and it mm-hmm. keeps deconstructing. And it's so funny because, of course, as a fiction writer, I just sort of part of what I do is conscious and part of it isn't. And it's really hard sometimes to pull it all apart. And I don't know why I make the choices I make, why one character is literally disappearing and the other ones are just sort of metaphorically invisible. I mean, the one who literally is also metaphorically. Or why the book is constructed in categories. Or why the fixation on the heart and the different ways of depicting it. I'm not really sure I can even add to what you've just said, which seems to me true, but is also, you know, it's like one part deliberate, one part accident. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say.
But as a result, hearts, moons,
yeah, the moons,
mirrors,
mm-hmm.
and a concern with visualization and vocalization between Narcissus on the one hand, worshipping his own image, and Echo repeating mm-hmm. hers. These things become ghostly presences in the book, and mm-hmm. it's as if what Kiki is trying to do, or what the book tries to do for Kiki, is to assemble a whole to which she has discovered pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she does seem to operate in a world that seems broken to her and in pieces. And I know, too, they're talking about that. There's a part where Collier is with Gordon, her lover, and she's thinking about his wife, and she's thinking about what a life with Gordon would be. And she suddenly is aware of this other presence, and she thinks, you know, who is it? Is it his wife? Is it her? Is it other women? She's not sure. And then she realizes that she entered his life, as she says, so softly and so invisibly, and wonders if a life with him would include other women entering as invisibly and softly as she has. And further, would she end up, is she sort of on some level a ghost within Gordon's life, and perhaps like the tale of the woman who haunts her own home, which was a story I'd seen on TV like years ago, where this woman would wake up every day because she'd hear a car pull up and she'd hear someone at the door, and then she'd hear them wander off, and she never knew who it was, and she knew her house was haunted, and it made her crazy. And finally, one day, because she would have to lay down for a nap for this to happen, and one day she didn't lay down for the nap, and she waited, and she discovered it was her. Mm-hmm. And so there's a ghosting and entering and leaving and a piecemeal approach to the structure of the book and to the way Kiki thinks and the way she's trying to really assemble her own life out of these blocks.
How did Man Ray enter as a presence, or Kiki for that matter?
Well, I knew that when I began this book, I knew I wanted to write about a woman aging and invisibility. And I knew the book would be divided into categories, though I didn't know why at that point. You can't just divide a book into categories because you feel like it. I mean, it has to sort of, you know, attach to the content or the story or the characterization. And I knew that my main character was going to be Kiki, and I knew that it would end with Man Ray's Kiki, or Kiki de Montparnasse. And I did not know how I would connect all these things. And when I sat down, that's what I began with. And I kept thinking, Kiki de Montparnasse, I mean, she's never been a particular hero of mine, or, I mean, I've always loved Man Ray and been much more involved with Man Ray than this model. But I thought, well, you know, she's in this book, and I don't know how. And I thought, oh, it's because my Kiki was named after that Kiki. And I thought, no, it's more than that, and she's going to show up. And the other thing is, I mean, she's, you know, she's dead. She's been dead a long time. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to write any sort of magical realism particularly. But I realized, too, that since I'd given Kiki Shaw this fantastic premise of literally disappearing, that she needed a fantastic ending. And that, and then I realized that's why Kiki de Montparnasse had to be there, because she was a fantastic element. And this is all by way of talking about constructing a fiction or constructing
exactly.
a novel. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that interested me was that I came to feel, at the end of the book, in conversation with Kiki, she talks about one of Man Ray's rayograms, and she says, those were my beads.
Yeah.
And, but there is a way, those photographs of Man Ray's, which are...
Oh, the solarizations?
Yeah, which are sort of the essences of things. They're images mm-hmm. raised to this level of significance, even though they are small details, is very much the way the images feel in this book, that a brooch will become a whole net of symbols, and mm-hmm. that the book seems like an X-ray, and entering the essence of a whole group of women, of relationships, of ways of thinking about interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked, you know,
okay.
that the book had a kind of relation between a male artist and a female model as a paradigm for a lot of other things. The mm-hmm. book turns out to be about, in many senses, forms of independence.
Yes, yes. And also, I think in writing this, it was very hard. An ending for a book like this is very difficult because I didn't want, say, a radical feminist ending. I didn't want a Prince Charming ending. I didn't want a self-help ending. I wanted something for the other women, you know, the sort of ends of their tales. I wanted them not to be endings so much as beginnings, which I think they are because they all sort of take like a little left turn. I wanted their resolutions, if you can call them that. I wanted them very quiet, and I wanted them to seem more realistic, just as I wanted Kiki's. It seemed it should be a little more fantastic. And I wanted to get through this idea that, because I'm, now that I've been talking about this book so much, I'm constantly asked, well, what do you think makes people visible? And not that I know the answer, because I'm not a sociologist, and I don't write nonfiction, and okay, and I'm not God. But I think finally what makes us visible to each other is something that's so simplistic it almost sounds sentimental or strange, but I think that respect makes us visible, and in that, you know, listening to each other, being aware of each other, I think compassion makes us visible, and I think that finally love makes us very visible, and that if we cease to love or cease to receive love, we become absent within our own lives, and love makes us present. And so I don't know that you can make a general answer to that we're suddenly going to wake up tomorrow and have new respect for elderly people in our society or something like that, and particularly women, or we're suddenly going to stop desexualizing women as they get older. But I think that sort of those three things, and there's a number of other things too, and that's, again, what I wanted to talk about or a little bit in this book, because I suddenly sort of painted myself into a corner thinking, well, what's going to make you – what is the story or what is the final thought that's going to – bring this character back into visibility? And I thought, well, if she can understand that there's that we're separate, but we're also interdependent or something. This sounds so terrible as I'm saying it. I feel like I'm on a talk show. I never talk about things like, you know, self-esteem or, you know, those kinds of things don't interest me much. But just the idea, I love the idea that for me, writing a book now in the, you know, tail end of the 20th century, I'm writing about a model who came to prominence at the beginning of this century. And even as she's saying, well, I made him famous and he made me famous, she can say that as a character. But it's also true because me, Whitney Otto, has written a little bit about her story. So she has had impact, you know. And I don't know. So
in the middle of... Well, actually, it's toward the beginning of Now You See Her by my guest, Whitney Otto. It's published by Villard. There's a chapter that I thought was uncharacteristic of the rest of the book, but extremely beautiful. Two men are out in the backyard of a party. It's a chapter that's arrived at by a double hallucination. Kiki is looking at a picture of her mother and her mother's first husband. And the picture is taken in front of a window and there's a party next door. Mm-hmm. And Kiki imagines the neighbor husband telling her father, now separated from her mother, about how his wife has come no longer to love him.
Yeah.
And it's such a, you know, haunting chapter. I wondered how it came about, because for the most part, the rest of the book is women's voices or woman with male interviewer.
Well, it was I hadn't meant too much to go into sort of the thoughts of the men in the book, only because if you do it once, you seem to need to do it many times. I mean, that's sort of one of those kind of silly rules of fiction, you know, put more in or take it out altogether. And so, and which obviously can be done, you know, successfully, I mean, broken successfully. But he was so compelling for me as a writer. And I felt so bad for him because I thought, here's this man, a man of the 50s, who has never wanted anything more than to be a family man. And that is his desire. And he cannot have it. I mean, his wife is restless. I mean, she's feeling other, I think, socio-political forces or something. And I liked the idea of these two men in the 50s with their houses and their families and this idea that they have it all. You know, that this was some sort of height of domesticity for the American male, and that they just are utterly baffled by these women that they share homes with and they share a bed with and they share children with. And they don't know how to cope with these drifting women that just seem to be so elusive. I mean, there but gone, and I don't know. And I liked writing that scene a lot. And it's true. I think you're right. I think it doesn't exactly fit into the book.
But what's nice about it is the way it sort of emerges as from the bottom of a well. You know,
yeah.
it passes through several states of consciousness before it arrives to us, and it comes to Kiki as a result of more or less having a seance with a photograph she mm-hmm. happens to have, and so that there is, mm-hmm. and of course, the problem between the two men too is that Kiki's father doesn't want to hear the other man's pain. And so this is a case of invisibility between men, you know?
Oh, yeah, he absolutely. I mean, he, at one point, this man is telling him some very personal things, and he even whispers, stop. And he just, but he's rooted to the spot at the same time. He can't seem to walk away from him. And it is, it's very hard for him to hear these things. And they do resonate in his own marriage, too. And I know, I felt bad for Walt in my book. Sometimes with my characters, they end up having lives that I'm sorry they have to have. And you think as the writer, as the god of the novel, that I would be able to fix things for them, and I can't. You know, that's another one of those peculiar things, I think, in writing. And with Walt, he finally ends up sort of the disappearing husband, and he is one of the men, perhaps the only man in there that really just sort of, you know, eventually lifts up and out of the book. He's just gone. But yeah, I think with the men in the book, and in some ways in the men, with the men in How to Make an American Quilt, they're really, the core of the book is always the women, and they're really on the periphery. And I try and give them their humanity even as they don't really have a focus. But Walt just sort of snuck in there and had some focus of his own. I don't like to, because I write about women a lot, I really don't like to either trash the men or lay blame, you know, on these men and say, you know, these women would just be happy. They just have better lives if you were a better person. but the men are as flawed as the women are. And the flaws in the men sometimes I want to explore them as a writer, but then I have to sort of, you know, keep control of what I'm writing about. So,
well, oddly, Walt and Luke are both very tender, you
mm-hmm.
know, sweet characters.
Yeah. Luke's very sweet, I think.
He's a cook.
Yeah. Always a number one thing.
I've been talking to Whitney Otto about her new novel, Now You See Her, recently published by Villard. Thank you for coming and joining us.
Oh, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Theo Mondel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books.
Too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.